Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
A panoramic picture taken in June 1919, the first summer of the hospital's existence, shows the men posing outdoors in a long line several rows deep in front of the main entrance. A few patients who've remained inside the hospital peer through the windows. The curved headboards of their iron bed frames are visible, pillows propped against each. Almost all of the subjects in the front row are missing a leg and pose with a pair of crutches. Behind them, arms rest in slings, sleeves hang empty. Are the men bored? Tired? Hot? The men are wearing their uniforms, but they don't have the smart, crisp look apparent in so many military portraits. Much of the clothing is rumpled and ill-fitting, hats askew, pocket flaps curling. The uniforms have seen action too.
What made you want to write about the former Christie Street Veterans Hospital?
I became curious about what the First World War was like in Toronto, where I live. And so I started doing just research out of curiosity, you know, who were the people who served, who lived here, and what was going on in the war at that time. And I stumbled upon this great book that had been digitized and put online. It was put together in about 1920, and it was all full of these candid photographs of patients of a hospital called the Christie Street Hospital, or the Dominion Orthopedic Hospital at that time. It had these wonderful photos of people banding together with crutches and missing limbs and different wards that were in the hospital. And then there were also pages and pages of names and service numbers. I realized that I could probably match up a lot of these people with their records and find out more about who they were and what their injuries were and who they'd been before the war.
You use the metaphor of a roosting box to describe the hospital. Why?
I was very interested in using bird imagery in the book. I thought it was fascinating that birds continued to be present in the war zones, and ornithologists often, amateur ornithologists would often write about birds. And so I was trying to weave that into the story. And then I came across a book that talked about roosting boxes being places of temporary shelter for birds to protect them from the elements or from, you know, difficult situations in a period of their migration. And I just thought that would be an interesting metaphor for the hospital itself. This place where all the men were gathered together, hopefully for a short period of time, but actually for some of them it was for the rest of their lives.
What were the type of injuries soldiers were coming back with when they came to not only Canada, but to this hospital in particular?
Oh my gosh, all kinds of injuries. Really, it's quite shocking to, when you really start diving in and realizing what these people went through. And originally the hospital had been an orthopedic hospital, so they were treating orthopedic wounds only. But then over time it grew to take in all kinds of other patients as other specialty hospitals were closing around Canada. So what I ended up doing was dividing the book into chapters about legs, faces, arms, spines, minds, bellies, and approaching it that way. There were so many stories that I came across that were really inspiring, where people were really able to deal with this change in their bodies and continue to move on.
Well, we'll talk about one of those people. I think you're maybe talking about Stuart Calhoun. Tell me who he is.
He was a young man in his early 20s from a rural Quebec area, went overseas and suffered a terrible wounds in the Battle of Passchendaele. So he had many wounds all over his body, but the most severe was a wound to his face. So he lost his nose and his eye, and just had, you know, a horrible time recovering from that. He was sent to a hospital in Britain for a period of time, and then eventually back to the Christie Street Hospital. And this time, plastic surgery was really in its infancy. And he went through something like 38 surgeries over a period of time, and then ended up actually always wearing a mask because they were never actually able to properly rebuild his nose. But he went on to have, you know, a life, and he married a woman who actually came to visit him in the hospital. He and this woman ended up falling in love and moving to Northern Ontario.
I want to pick up on plastic surgery, the way it was described in the book, A Strange New Art. Can you walk me through, because we see these photos of sort of what looks like skin being draped over faces and masks and stuff. What was the actual surgeries like?
One of the reasons that this is so easy for me to visualize is that there were artists who would draw the stages of these surgeries. So this image comes from the University of Toronto archives, and it shows artists at work at the Christie Street Hospital. So you can see on the back wall, there's all kinds of drawings of the different patients and their wounds. And there's also photographs on the wall as well that show the men with their injuries. And the man in the back is a sculptor named Frederick Coates, who would have worked closely with the facial surgeons. And the women in the front are Anne Savage and Dorothy Coles, two women who started out as painters and came to work very closely with the men with facial injuries. And their job was to sit in on the surgeries and draw each stage so that there would be a record of what had happened afterwards. And one of the drawings was of Stewart's surgery, and it shows this, what's called the tubed pedicle method. A large part of his nose was gone, and they would cut a piece of skin from his chest, stitch it into a tube, sew it onto the place that needed to be repaired, after also bone grafting to build up that area, and, you know, stitch it into a tube so that it was still alive. It was still alive here and feeding this part here. And then once it had adhered and, you know, knitted into place, then the tube part of it could be cut away. But these were also, you can imagine, you could only do tiny parts of these surgeries at a time, because each part that you worked on had to then have time to heal. So Stewart was in the hospital for a long, long time. And I became very interested in his story. So I started, you know, snooping around. And I did this with a lot of the characters, trying to find family members now who could tell me just a little bit about the lives of these people then. And I found someone by the name Colquhoun from that general area in Northern Ontario where Stewart had settled after the war. But I couldn't find an email address or anything like that, but I found a mailing address, and I wrote a letter and asked, you know, if this person was related, and just generally kind of very tentatively putting those feelers out. And I got a lovely letter back from this 90-year-old man who turned out to be Stewart's son. And he was in the hospital at the time because he had fallen and broken his hip. But he put all my fears at ease. He said, you know, I would be more than happy to talk to you about my dad. So we ended up having all these phone conversations where he was able to really fill me in on Stewart's life and just add wonderful details that I would never have been able to come across otherwise. And then shortly after that, he died in the hospital And this is something that happened a few times with people that I interviewed who were very old, who were children or grandchildren of the subjects that I was looking for. I think they were so happy that someone wanted to know the stories of these ordinary people. So it was really a special feeling to be able to do that just in time, you know?
One of the things that was quite unique was this rooftop ward on Christie Street Hospital.
So this image is taken from the rooftop of the Christie Street Hospital. It's on one of the visits of the Prince of Wales to the hospital. And you can see here how the beds are very close together all along the roof, and they're in the bright sunshine. The rooftop ward was where heliotherapy went on. So the sun cure, what they hoped would be a cure for men with tuberculosis. So the men were put up there and they would basically bask in the sunshine. They had to do it gradually, you know, a little bit at a time, at first maybe 15 minutes and then an hour and then two. But they would lie kind of exposed with sunglasses on, and it just became this kind of gathering place. A lot of the other patients would also go up and hang out on the roof ward. And two of the men who were patients on the roof ward started a little hospital newsletter called the Hamilton Mills Weekly. And they were probably very bored a lot of the time because they were being tuberculosis patients. They were supposed to be having just bed rest and just lying around in their beds all the time. But they had these mirrors rigged up also so that they could see different parts of the roof ward. And different things going on. So, and one of the men did the writing for the newsletter and gathered these funny stories and made fun of other patients and nurses coming to steal their chocolate and all these kinds of things. And the other man would do the like little cartoon drawings and things for the hospital.
Disease and illness was rampant shortly after the war. And for a lot of people who've just come out of COVID, if they're reading this, they might be like, this sounds very similar when we're talking about sort of the ads, the literature, the policies right. that were put in place of the flu epidemic that was happening, yeah. That you used sort of ads that you could easily have replicated yes. here. How similar was that to, and how difficult was it to not only take care of wounded veterans, but also deal with an epidemic?
Yeah. It was really interesting researching the lungs chapter, as I called it, which basically focused on the Spanish flu while COVID was happening. And I was amazed to read the descriptions in the newspapers about, everybody staying apart from each other and not gathering in crowded spaces, not going to church as they would always do, and, staying off of the streetcars and all of these kinds of things, and wearing masks. But the masks that they would wear were these kind of see-through. I don't think they probably worked very well. But also there were long descriptions. There were not enough trained nurses to be able to care for all of the people who were suffering from flu. So they were encouraging ordinary women to go to these workshops they would have that would tell them how you care for someone who's sick. And just an amazing time, especially, you know, going through COVID here and being locked down for much of the time that I was writing the book. It was really something.
While the hospital is the centerpiece of the book, you take readers from the hospital rooftop to the trenches on the front line of the war, but you go on to mention while the war is over, there's still sadness. Tell me about what that actually meant.
You see all these pictures from us looking at this nowadays. We look back on all these pictures of everyone being so joyous at the end of the war. But then when you actually dig into the histories and the writings of what people actually felt, it was not that simple. It was very complicated. People had been through such misery. They'd lost friends and family, they'd been horribly wounded, maybe they'd even killed people themselves. And so when the war ended, it was kind of like, I'm sure it must have felt like, what was all that for? Like, how did we end up here? And then I think also, when you try to think of this period from the perspective of those people, to know that in a very short period of time, another war happened. So it was not the war to end all wars. I try to imagine how profoundly changed these people were from this experience. And it's really hard to wrap your head around.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.